Warning. This episode openly discusses diversity and queer expression and feminist perspectives on BL culture and queer media. This talk aims to widen people's opinions on BL and hopefully lessen vitriol surrounding the BL community.
Hey, good day, everyone. I'm Kirsten Santos, and welcome to another episode of FujojoCast, which is I'm realizing a podcast that I just really run when I feel like it and when I want to talk about things with people who I want to talk with or people I want to listen from. Yeah. And for today, I think this podcast is long overdue in many ways. And I think in the last 2 or 3 years, this has been a topic that we'd frequently run into as a BL scholar, given the history of this blog and this podcast. As a BL scholar, these are things that we run into from time to time. And I'll be honest, at one point I haven't had the energy to keep up with it because it has been quite forward and it has been quite visible in the past few years. And, I think this is definitely the time to talk about it. And I guess I'm here with people who have been more abreast than I am, more in touch than I am, not just because of age, but because of knowledge and expertise as well. Is that me admitting that I am no longer a social media animal? But nonetheless, I'm here with two wonderful people who have been abreast with these issues concerning these discussions, these discourses surrounding BL online. So first, we have Samantha Aburime, an independent scholar. Hello, Sam.
Hello.
Yes. And so Sam has been very vocal and she has this wonderful list of BL scholarship online. So I think you guys should check it out. And then next we have a frequent guest. Should I start paying him? No, I can't afford him. Next we have Thomas Bodinet. I'm a senior lecturer from the University of Macquarie. Hi, Tom.
Hello again. As always, lovely to be here.
Of course. I'll pay you with coffee next time. That's what I can afford. So we have Sam and Tom this day with us. And we're here to really talk about the different, I guess, misconceptions that we have been reading regarding Fujoshi culture, BL culture within Anglophone discourses. Over the years, we've encountered it within terms of representation, when a new television show comes out and it's a queer television show, it's always pegged against BL culture. And of course, when people start learning about BL culture, they start getting into comics. And recently there has been an interview that sparked some concern again about how BL is understood and how BL is appreciated. And I think all of those things come together and all of those things speak about a wider culture regarding BL. And we're probably seeing just the English aspects of it. But as Tom and I would know, that there are global dimensions to these misunderstandings and to these misconceptions regarding BL. So I guess I'll start with the heavy question. Where do these misconceptions come from?
I mean, to start, and if you don't mind me kind of stepping in, we're talking here about what we could variously call misconceptions, misunderstandings, or I would prefer the term misreadings boys' love as a phenomenon. And I think that when we talk about that, it's kind of important to put on the table what specific kinds of discourse we're responding to here before we can even determine where they come from. I mean, we're talking about these discourses that tend to be fairly dismissive of boys' love as a kind of genre, for instance, whether they're dismissing it as a genre of queer media because of its creation historically by primarily heterosexual women or people who identified publicly as heterosexual women, I think it's always important to put in that little caveat. And also kind of claims around the norms, the representational norms of boys' love nowadays versus its classic kind of expression back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. I think mm-hmm. that what we're really kind of, the crux of what we're talking about here is the ways in which the debate that we witness primarily within Anglophone fandom spaces, or maybe not even fandom spaces, because some of the people engaging with this are not fans, right? But Anglophone discussion spaces tied to primarily, I would say, you know, discussion of Japanese popular culture. But of course, it sometimes ties into discussions of North American popular culture, Korean popular culture, Thai popular culture, etc. That I would use the word ossified. So they've become stagnant. What I've noticed and what I've been arguing against in my social media, in my scholarship, in my public outreach, and I think Sam has as well, and I'll throw to Sam soon, is that Anglophone discourse on boys' love has reached this point where it's recirculating the same arguments again and again. Whereas what's significant is that this recirculation and rehashing of arguments about boys' love, particularly framed through either so-called queer or feminist perspectives, but perhaps not necessarily the most kind of up-to-date queer
intersectional as well.
Exactly, exactly.
Lacking intersectionality.
Have basically not moved forward within Anglophone discussion, whereas Kirsten, you and I, who are embedded within the Japanese scholarship landscape and the Japanese language kind of discourse, are well aware of the fact that we've moved beyond this. Yeah. And likewise, Sam, you've been doing excellent work tracing how some of this, as I said, ossified, stilted misrepresentations, misreadings, whatever you want to call them, of BL culture within Anglophone spaces is actually tied to the emergence of more, let's say, nefarious discourses within social media and within contemporary youth culture. So yeah, I might throw to Sam, but that's I think before even thinking about where are these discourses coming from, it's important to know what the discourses actually are. BL is bad representation. BL is filled with rape. BL is dangerous because it perverts the minds of people, etc. These are the sorts of discourses that we're considering as misunderstandings or misreadings. That BL is anti-feminist and anti-queer.
Sam?
That was a really good summary of it, pretty much. But in what I've been looking at, I keep finding that it centers around to like three different things, and like one of the key ones is of course kind of like a national exceptionalism, you know, usually American exceptionalism or Western exceptionalism. It's like the main problem is approaching everything from that lens. You're not interested in why something is like this or how something is like this. You know, they go straight to, oh, those Japanese people are weird. They make weird cartoons and make weird comics, and we don't have anything like that here, you know. And so it's setting up a discussion for failure because it's not equating equals, while at the same time it's also like not interested in engaging with any significant cultural conversation or back and forth. They don't care about understanding per se. It makes it kind of an easy target. And because I think of the language barriers as well, you don't see as many like Japanese or Chinese maybe authors directly, or you know, any activists per se, you know, in deeply involved in English spaces to refute that. So people just kind of, it gets recycled and recycled into an echo chamber. It just keeps echoing and getting louder and louder because no one's refuting what they're saying, really. And I was just gonna say, and like along with that exceptionalism, there's also like, there's a conservatism to it because which we might touch on later. We've seen there's been anti-trans arguments against BL. I've seen pop up in Japan, China, and, you know, the United States, UK. So, I mean, there's definitely something going on there with people trying to draw this connection between BL and what they might put as women confusing their sexuality or women being trans, you know. And it's really wild that it all kind of interconnects and overlaps a lot.
No, it's really interesting because a few years ago we witnessed this exact kind of discourse emerged in South Korea from the radical feminist movement there, principally the group known as Magalia, who were pushing the idea that BL was anti-feminist, and Kim Hyo-jin, a colleague of Christine and myself, and a good friend as well, you know, has done a lot of work looking at this kind of leaving BL discourse that emerged out of this radical feminist space in Korea. But the corollary of all this is that the radical feminist space in Korea, Magalia, and the way that feminism is operated within that specific space in South Korea has what we could call trans exclusionary radical feminist elements involved. And indeed, if you look deeper into where this discourse of BL, leaving BL and needing to move away from it as a feminist text because of its potential, you know, transing and its ambiguities of gender and blah, 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 it was actually partly circulated by like this right-wing Christian group that was using it as a kind of a psyop. So what I think important here is that, to kind of go back to that, is that we see the penetration of some of these discourses by what I would call bad agents, but also this kind of disagreement over what feminism is. And Sam, you mentioned the term intersectionality, and I think that that's really important. You know, the kind of foundation of what we would call the third wave feminist movement is the idea of this intersectional need. And some of the recent work on BL, which has turned away, as I said, from questions of representation, questions of use, and questions of meaning-making through practice, has been driven by Japanese feminist theorists of BL, a few of whom we'll probably talk about today, as an attempt to kind of think intersectionally. And then that kind of discourse hasn't necessarily truly kind of spread into Anglophone spaces because Don't get us wrong. Of course, there are Japanese BL fans operating in Anglophone spaces who do engage with these sorts of discourses and do think about these things. But I would say that unfortunately, you're still seeing the circulation of very problematic discourses around BL. Partly because, for instance, media legacy news media tends to resuscitate them in their attempts to make sense of things as well. And we see scholars who aren't Japanese language proficient continue to produce the same sorts of arguments, which now that there's a bunch of us doing decent peer review, that's becoming less of the case, but it's still circulating.
And I think it's also the selective, there is some sense of selection that comes with the information that what these particular news outlets would also choose to write about, right? Meaning part of why this kind of idea of BL is bad, but BL is quote unquote bad, persists is that, you know, you also have, you know, legitimate media outlets who are positioning particular arguments, putting forward particular issues without really, you know, understanding context and to a certain extent interviewing people. We've seen it being done here in the Philippines. We've seen it being done in various spaces that I guess the writers have their own sense of, I guess, logics as to why they view BL in a particular manner. And regardless of whether Tom and I are interviewed by those, you know, journalists or articles, it is because of the politics of these journalists that, you know, sometimes they'll just selectively choose something that sounds nice to them rather than really something that, you know.
Yeah, the idea that I mean, a lot of what we're talking about here, whether it be journalists or social media
Yes.
discourse, it's about cherry picking to pre
Yeah.
to confirm a pre-existing
Exactly.
argument
Exactly.
rather than developing an appreciation. Like I went into my study of BL as an academic back when I was doing my PhD, fully kind of having, let's say, drunk some of the Kool-Aid around you know, some of the problems of BL, quote unquote, you know, and that's because I was engaging with it at a time when, you know, the Yaoi Ransoul was still going on, and the English language scholarship of scholars such as Mark McClelland, which were asking very specific set questions that were very much questions that made sense in the 1990s, early 2000s when he was doing the work. You know, like I went in, but, you know, as a scholar, when I met people in Japan, particularly, you know, gay men who the scholarship had told me don't like BL, and they told me, oh yeah, I like BL. BL's important to me. What was important was that I approached those kinds of ideas with good faith. So rather than that, there is a tendency within scholarship, for instance, that when you encounter, particularly in feminist scholarship, you know, that you'll see, you know, people who will supposedly be consuming a problematic form of media, and then you can dismiss them as having developed some kind of false consciousness through consuming that media. I think that that's a very dangerous and indeed unfeminist approach, because it kind of denies the agency of the consumer to make their choices. Now, yes, that agency may be constrained under a system of capitalist accumulation, blah, 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 blah. But what I think is left out of the discussion often when we focus too much on the structural limitations is that individuals navigate those structures and need to do so in ways that are important for their flourishing, is how I would frame it. So like they'll do it in ways that are designed to be emancipatory, designed to intervene in their disadvantage and so forth. And a lot of the recent boys love scholarship that has emerged out of the Japanese context, this is the question that they're interested in. It's not boys love is a problematic genre with terrible representational politics that resuscitates heteronormative norms through the semi-uke structure, and that it's about, you know, appropriation of gay male images and blah 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 blah. That discussion is well and truly had, right? And as many of us will note, for example, Akiko Mizuguchi in her very, very famous work on the evolutionary form of BL, BL Shinkaron, is that yes, and in response to these criticisms, boys' love developed and changed and has become reflective. And the thing is that a lot of people don't take that into account when they discuss boys' love, right? Is that the genre, when it came into contact with legitimate criticisms around it, some of its representational politics and some of the ways in which it was discussing, you know, queer issues, it changed. Now, yes, you still have the stuff that represents some of the poorer quality, perhaps, representations, but like that's the same of any kind of genre. I mean, it's true of romance fiction too. Romance fiction has had its moment where it has evolved to include, you know, people of the perspectives of people of color, to include queerness, to complicate patriarchy within the narratives. But at the same time, you still have the classic romance texts sitting within the same environment. So I guess one of the things that frustrates me about some of the criticisms that we get of BL from Japan, from Korea, from Thailand, is that there's this attempt to like just say BL is this without thinking about the fact that it is incredibly diverse as a genre. And
And
also the BL they talk about is the BL of the 90s, not the BL of the 2020s.
it's like they're holding on to this image of
They're clinging
BL.
to it for
They're
dear
clinging
life.
to it. And you know, and it's quite interesting as well because, you know, I've had students come up to me. I've told this to Tom a couple of times. I've had students come up to me and they know I study BL and they say, you know, is it right for me to consume this kind of media? And in fact, in the recent Blush Convention, even a teacher said, what do I tell my students when they tell that? And I say, you know, and it's difficult in a sense that I do understand that there are different local contexts that shape the consumption or why they're motivated to consume this, right? Meaning, for example, you can't force a Catholic schoolgirl to just kind of, you know, pick up, well, she may have picked up the BL once, but and read it and be like, oh no, right? closing her, you know, hands over her face with one eye peeking out, you know. And
are you speaking from personal experience?
Oh no, I was all in from the beginning. I was like, yes. Unleash. But I also had my hesitations about it. And one thing that I think in terms of local context is that at the, you know, especially like in Japan, they always talk about this idea of young women becoming empowered by making the choice to read BL. And and I'm also seeing that here in the Philippines when they're like, oh, so we can do this with this kind of media. We can experiment with that. We can push that. And I think in terms of looking at whether BL is good or bad, what I often tell my students is that actually you can make the decision whether it's good or bad for you based on your own set of morals and values. And I can't tell them it's bad. I'll tell them, of course, always it's good. You know, it hasn't done me wrong so far. I didn't imagine that 10 years, no, more than 10 years, that when I started my blog as a fujoshi, I would be writing and making a living out of it. But here I am. But I think how you and Tom, how Sam and Tom have gone through it, I also had to go through that process of unpacking how can I understand BL better and under what feminist praxis, for example, would make me be more considerate and be more mindful of how I consume it. And certainly an intersectional approach was very helpful. And to a certain extent, you know, scholars from Japan had helped position that. And even my own experience being someone, as they would call it, in earlier Anglophone discourse, like when I guess Sam was still a bab. But they would call, like, if they referred, like if I spoke online with my Anglophone friends in manga, etc., the Philippines would count because we're considered part of the periphery, but I think it's that positionality of periphery that also allowed me to have a very intersectional understanding. And I think that is powerful, and that how particular contexts can really shape your feminist reading or your feminist approach to BL. Sam, your thoughts?
Yeah, I feel like one of the most important aspects of the discussion that always gets left out is just like what coming from that intersectional perspective that people don't consider is, you know, let people speak for themselves and then you elevate their voices.
Hmm.
Like we understand that in our own personal, you know, local culture, you know, Black Lives Matter, LGBTQ issues, things like that. And you know that like being a good ally is letting people speak for themselves. But like the way BL has been so demonized, it's framed these women and like any consumers basically as evil people who are directly harming, you know, the queer community as we speak. They're trying, you know, pushing it as like it's homophobic, it's fetishistic, etc. Again, which I've found has many roots to anti-trans language. That it's like it's like everything I look into, it always comes back to that. I'm like, my God.
But yeah.
But like, you know, honestly, it's kind of like that's how people have shut off the discussion or shut off any discussion for it. It's kind of like, I'm not going to listen to a fujo, or fujos are mentally ill, you know, they aren't real people, you know, making jokes about committing violence against them. And they don't consider, you know, a fujoshi to be like, you know, a queer lesbian, like butch in Japan, you know, or whatever, or a trans man or a gay man, you know, who like in regular circumstances, what they would be saying to them would be considered a hate crime. you know, they make light of it, and they dehumanize it so much that it becomes unworthy of any respect or critical thought, which makes it even harder for people to point out, hey, this is really harmful and racist, actually, and here is why, when it comes to that discussion.
Yeah.
This reminds me of some of the work that Mark McClelland did at the very end of his career, talking about how scholars who work on, let's say, controversial media from Japan, whether that be boys' love or pornography or Lolita subcultures or whatever, there is a tendency for their academic expertise, for instance, to be dismissed because of the very act of engaging with the media, which is considered problematic. And this is this is part of that wider problem, is that there is this kind of idea that, well, I shouldn't ever take you seriously because you are a, you know, you've been by engaging yourself with the culture has thus turned you into an enemy. And that is, well, I mean, that's not good feminist praxis to start with, like, because feminism as an approach is all about both self-reflexivity, but also listening to others. And definitely listening to the voices of the marginalized. And then the other thing is, like, the good feminist praxis and good queer praxis, of course, because I think that they're both linked, is about speaking back to power, right? And one of the things that dismissal of alternative viewpoints does is that it means that you're not speaking back to power. You're merely denying legitimacy to anyone who has an opinion that differs to your own. And what really kind of shocks me is that within, as I said, contemporary feminist debates over boys' love in Japan and contemporary queer debates about boys' love in Japan, where we're seeing, you know, particularly, and the reason I bring up gay men, it's not to silence queer women, because queer women are very, very significant within boys' love critique and boys' love history. But it was gay men in particular, or bisexual men, but, you know, sex, queer men that mobilized the privilege of their cisgendered nature to silence BL fans' voices, right? And that was a form of, I don't want to use the word misogyny because that's too strong, but there was a certain patriarchal undercurrent to the ways in which the yaoi ronso played out, that you know, being sensitive to intersectionality, why have men villainized a female focused, you know, media phenomenon or fandom culture? And, you know, and a lot of the work that I've been doing around, you know, gay men's interaction with female fandom in Japan, I do encounter these sorts of voices that seek to delegitimate or vilify, you know, women for engaging with the culture that is there for them, right? And I think that that's really dangerous because, you know, boys love, yes, I think one of the things here that I often say is that, yes, boys love has problematic representational politics. So does every other media text and genre in the world. The thing is that we engage with that and critically reflect on that. This idea that you just watch BL and then you come out of it with no appreciation for like the it's the same sort of debates as, like, you know, just playing violent video games make you a violent person.
Yeah.
Like these sorts of arguments are not, you know, for academics working within media theory, they're not productive discussions because they're much too simplistic. I mean, they don't take into account the more nuanced nature. So you know, a lot of the feminist work in Japan has sought to think, okay, so what do women do with these texts? How do they engage with this? One of the most, I think, influential and important texts is a book by a scholar and colleague named Mori Naoko. She wrote a book called Onna wa Porno o Yomu, Women Read Porn. And she looks at a variety of different pornographic manga genres in Japan.
And she boys counted love. Pages.
Yes, I found boys the love method. Being one of them.
Yeah.
Anyway, but what she was saying is, like, she's not like, okay, so yeah, there's like a lot of rape in this. Why do women read this? And this is like really basic stuff from like romance studies. Like, why are women reading taboo stuff? Well, because the taboo allows them to escape from the strictures of heteropatriarchy and like, it allows them to engage with fantasies and desires that they're unable to articulate within a heteropatriarchal society. And this is like this is one of the things, you know, when people are like, oh, Boys Love's bad because of all the rapey nonsense. One, well, some of the rapey nonsense is gone now. Two, like, we're seeing consent being discussed in much more appropriate ways in contemporary work. But three, there is always going to be a place for people to explore the eroticization of taboo. And I think that's okay. And that these people may consume it fully aware of the fact that it's problematic. And I think that's what people neglect in this sort of discussion, is this idea that, well, I read BL that is rapey. Not all BL is rapey, just gonna put it out there. And that this thus makes you complicit in that kind of crime. And exactly. I think that it's a little bit more complicated than that. And that there's an ethical reflection that happens. Maybe not the first time you read that sort of text, but who knows? I remember the first time I encountered a BL text that was, as I said, to use that slangy term, rapey. And I was like, having to think about, do I like this? Is this what I like? Does it appeal to me? And really having to reflect on it. And that reflection was important.
I was going to say, what you recently mentioned reminded me of another thing too, is that a lot of people have pointed out in the discourse, you know, why are all of you looking for representation in pornography? You know, not all BL is porn.
Yeah.
But a lot of people will look at the craziest, you know, most insane. And it's not like the author isn't self-aware, you know.
Yeah.
They make stuff like this, you know, and because they like to and they want to. And then people are just like, oh, this is such bad representation. It's so unrealistic. And you're like, that's the point. You know,
it's like if you're looking for positive and realistic, like authentic representation in Big Dick Island, then I don't know what's like.
Yeah. Well, like I was thinking about this too. Like when I watched, like, what was it? I think there's a documentary called Circus of Books, and it was about like one of the most popular like gay porn stores in the US, you know, that was really big in like the 70s, I believe, you know, and really important to the community. And I was thinking, like, yeah, well, what if you went into one of those stores and you're like, where's the representation? Where, you know?
Yeah. And this is why I think
applying it to the wrong places.
Yeah. Representation is important. Like, it's important to discuss these things. And I don't want to dismiss the discussion over, for example, sexual consent and rape and so forth in Boys Love, because that's an important question that has important questions. Like, representations are important. And they need to be discussed, but it's not the end of the discussion, right?
Exactly.
And that's what has become, I think,
and
disappointing.
It's not the goal of every piece either.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, nowadays,
it's kind of like, oh, go ahead.
I was about to say that, I mean, in terms of exploration, we're not just looking at these kinds of representation. It even extends beyond human bodies, even for some.
Like, exactly. Yeah.
One of the biggest on trends are, you know, beasts, animals falling in love in that kind of situation. I mean, how are my cats supposed to represent particular BL, you know, very human affections, very human logics, right? But this is where this is where the fun part is of BL. It has always been historically a very experimental space for women, a very experimental space for them to look at the logics of romance, the logics of human interaction, of human, I guess, I wouldn't say essences, but, you know, it's but, you
it's
know,
having that control and that choice
and that
over what
that
narrative
choice,
you
precisely.
Engage with
precisely.
And what, yeah,
and,
you're in
and,
control
you know, how,
of the experience.
Yeah. And how far we can push it. And we've seen, you know, and one thing fascinating and one thing that why I'm still interested in BL in various media is that there's always, you know, that pushback that's happening. And it's very important, again, as Tom mentioned, between feminist and queer studies, you know, and feminist and queer actions, is that there is this pushback against really, you know, depending on where they are, where they live, you know, very oppressive contexts, you know, patriarch contexts that really stifle their creativity, that stifle their forms of expression. going into that, we've touched a bit on like BLM feminism in Japan, but I think Tom, you've mentioned this, and maybe our listeners don't know about it, but can you tell us a little bit more about Yaoi Ronso, beyond misogynics, but I think more on how has that been to a certain extent resolved? Because I think we, in the Anglophone discourse, we are encountering our Yaoi Ronso phase, right? We're in our Yaoi, referring to one of the labels regarding BL in the 1990s, Yamanashi, Ochinashi, Iminashi. You know, I've always been on a tiff that when you Google boys love, you're actually redirected to Yaoi, and the term has long been outdated in Japan and is now extensively used, but that's another story.
What is Yaoi? Don't you mean Yaoi?
Yaoi. Like, and Ronso would be debate, right? And I think it was in the 90s. It's been 30 years ago, but I think it's also important to ask how have they in Japan moved forward from that kind of debate?
Yeah, so the Yaoi Ronso, to put it in the simplest terms, was a moment. There was a publication, a feminist coterie magazine called Choisir. A gay activist named Sato Masaki wrote a piece in it about criticizing fans of Boys Love for appropriating representations of gay men in order to fuel their fantasies, and that these the representations in Boys Love did not match the kind of lived experiences of gay men in Japan. And in particular, he took issue with the static model of the seme-uke paradigm, kind of inscribing a binaristic male female heteronormative kind of representation of gay relationships. And then that sparked a 3-year back and forth between gay activist writers and Fujoshi fans and critics, who were basically the argument was over representation versus fantasy, or what I think we can boil down to the vexed question of authenticity, which I think is often a smokescreen for other sorts of questions. So basically, The charge was that BL as a kind of genre misrepresented and failed to engage with political questions relating to the lived experiences of gay men, and that it was therefore an anti-gay genre, that it was homophobic. And what emerged in response to that over a number of years, as I said, is what theorist Akiko Mizuguchi, whose first kind of response to all of this was, well, lesbian women have been reading and consuming and writing BL for decades, so queer women are involved, and you've just completely obliterated their engagement, as well as the fact that some of the people who write BL were also gay men. Like, you know, this is important to acknowledge. But her whole point was, well, actually, it wasn't that. Like, yes, in the immediate aftermath, some of the fans of Fujoshi, you know, the Fujoshi kind of buckled down and were reactive and so forth. But, you know, once that period of reactivity settled down, it led to questions, you know, well, maybe we do need to consider other ways of representing these things. Maybe we need to move away from the trope of I'm not gay, but I love you. That was kind of central to the classic BL of the 90s, commercial BL of the 90s. One thing that I always, and I think Kirsten will appreciate this, will always point out is that the world of doujinshi has never had many of these problems. Whereas commercial BL, which is run by heterosexual men who sit on the board of publishing companies dictating to those silly women authors how they should be writing their manga, had a very kind of conservative understanding of what was going on built into it, but at the same time, the world of doujinshi was much more expansive and much more radical in its representations. So this is the other thing, is the Yaoi Ronso was specifically focusing on commercial BL texts, even though it was called the Yaoi Ronso, and Yaoi at the time was used to refer to parodic, non-commercial doujinshi derivative works. So basically, Whilst, as I've already flagged, whilst the some of the problematic representations and what we could call classic BL continues, particularly within some of the commercial spaces, you know, the critically acclaimed popular stuff and the world of doujinshi has moved away from this. Like, we're like the idea of like I am you know, a straight man, but I love only you, that's gone. Like, yeah, there might be some instances where it's not necessarily explicitly stated, but the point is that people no longer, like, there's an expectation when a girl in Japan or a gay man reads a BL manga in Japan, half of the time the character is understood as being either gay or bisexual, right? Likewise, we've seen a similar trend in other spaces, like in Thailand, the Thai BL series that I research, similarly began with that trope, but now not at all. Like the characters are often either one of them identifies as gay, and then one of them might be. One of the things that I hate about this is, like, you know, this idea that, oh well, they're straight, and then they're like you know, falling in love with each other is like this kind of spiritual bond. It's kind of like, yeah, well, maybe these people just realize they're not straight for the first time in their life. Right.
Yeah.
Like, so this is the other thing. So this, there's been changes to BL over the last 30 years, which is why it's so frustrating to see the yaoi ronsou play out over and over again. And it's because, and you know, I'm going to say this with deep respect, but it's because of the impact of the work of our former colleague, Christine's former supervisor and my mentor, like Mark McClelland, because he wrote a book that was following the logics of the late 1990s, and he made an argument, and then that argument just gets constantly circulated. And I remember having a conversation with him at a conference, and he's just like, yeah, we need people, like, you guys need to take the next step because I'm out of date. Like, and like, I was told explicitly, I mean, he reviewed my book before it was published. It was one of the last things that he did before he passed away, unfortunately, was that he's like, yes, we need this out there now, because what I wrote based in the 1990s is no longer the case.
I echo that.
Yeah, and I also find it strange too, because I was introduced to a lot of his later or like mid works. Like, I know one of the most his works I like the most was, I think, published around 2006, and it was about like censorship, yaoi, and like online. And it was published in like a feminist legal review journal or something.
Yeah, yeah, the Australian.
And like, yeah, and like way back then, he was quoting some feminist scholars talking about how for some people, you know, BL characters might be third gender, or, you know, not male or female, like, you know, like broadening the horizons of discussion here. And yet people still are just like, I do not see it.
Yeah. And that's the thing, like my ideas have changed even like since I published my book, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is the thing, like, scholarship moves forward. And what annoys me about particularly the social media debate, is that it's not moving forward, and some of it's become very reactive. And as Sam, you've pointed out, that reactivity is being driven not by a kind of a feminist desire to think reflexively and intersectionally. It's actually being driven by people who have very, very, very kind of conservative politics, mm-hmm. that are designed to, it's reactive politics. So the anti-trans discourses that we can under the cover of it all, or the kind of universalizing approach to, you know, sexual development and sexual experience that underlines a lot of this. So the idea of the, you know, BL will lead you towards deviancy is about reinscribing the idea that only a particular kind of sexual experience or sexual life is correct. And, you know, for me, the queer theorist who's like, we must destroy all norms because they have led to oppression. It's like, why are we reinscribing heteronormative and heteropatriarchal appreciations and understandings of sex, romance?
We're going through a phase of bringing back the Hays Code, and you know, so it's like a combination of things. But because of, like, you know, the layers of social media, people who like believed those things or pushed those things got their own blogs. Yep. And they were, and they kind of positioned themselves as authority figures, you know, spreading disinformation and fandom, like, oh, if you read these fanfics, you're an abuser. If you like this, you're an abuser. If you, you know, if you read that, you're a fetishist, you're fetish, and you can even fetishize yourself, you're a bad person, you know. And then, like, because in like a lot of young readers, you know, hanging out on Tumblr, Twitter, people who, you know, haven't been introduced to, like, especially not queer activism or like sex positivity type culture, because those aren't things that are taught in schools. It feels like they absorbed it from there and kind of took it as a truth instead of just, you know, a, what do you call a snake oil salesman?
I would say a
random person with a blog exerts authority, but you don't actually know them or any of their sources.
And I think,
no,
I think
they just have a large following, so you listen to them.
Yeah, I think what for me is very important here, and something you were mentioning just there, Sam, is the focus on you're a bad person, right?
Yeah.
And like, if you're a young person who is coming to terms with your sexuality or who you are in the world, like, there's nothing worse than discourse that disempowers you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course that is going to lead you to then engage. Well, if there's all these people saying that what I'm doing is wrong, then it must be wrong, right? And hence I need to perform my goodness by demonstrating that I am not wrong. And
exactly.
This is not like, and I want to kind of return to this, like, this idea of feminist praxis. Like, feminist praxis is not disempowering. It can never be disempowering. So any kind of discourse that parades itself as kind of protecting the purity, and I'm going to use that word so we can segue into a discussion about it, but protecting the purity and the kind of development of young people.
It's protecting people's choices, not telling them what to choose, what to think.
Exactly. Yeah. So what we have here is a disempowering. And whereas the Japanese kind of feminist debate focuses on the empowering choices that consuming BL can have, even if it is having to negotiate one's relationship with problematic representations, because it isn't saying you are wrong for doing this, it allows people to reflect and develop a feminist praxis, whereas the converse is happening within some spaces in the Anglosphere, where we're seeing disempowerment becoming the norm. And that really, really concerns me politically.
Yeah.
I think there's also this interesting aspect in not just, I mean, when we think about it quite a lot, in the history of BL, quite a lot of its early producers are young women. They're basically, like, I know some of them are adolescent girls when they started. They were 14, 15, and they're developing. And we do know that there is a strong dismissal of, you know, culture of young women, that they're immature. They don't know anything about the world, etc. But this is really speaks of a higher patriarchal culture that, you know, is dismissive of them. But Tom is on point wherein one thing interesting that quite a lot of Japanese scholars have done is that they've looked at girl studies. They've looked at it's under the context of shoujo studies, and with it associated with BL in turn, is that they really tried to look for these young women and try to understand and unpack why was this form of media so important to them, and why and how did this enable them? How did this empower them? How did it, you know, in my research alone, how did a group of 500 young women who were like so super excited by these new things emerging in shoujo manga ended up being, you know, one of the most largest and celebrated events in fan events in Japan, which is Comic Market. And to add, continues to be a safe space for this kind of engagement, right? Meaning everybody understands that there's BL doujinshis there. Everybody understands everything that's bad and so on. But I mean, to look into that, and we understand that there are particular logics that's happening in Japan wherein women are empowered. And here we have purity politics happening and this conservatism that's happening in fan discourse. Sam, I know you've encountered them. And so what are some of the points or challenges that emerges from this kind of discussions?
From like the fan discourse stuff?
Yeah, on purity politics especially.
Oh yeah, I was just gonna say the core issue is definitely getting through to people. Because it gets kind of hammered into them on social media and online, because there's no like reference point, there's no textbook, you know, that people are going from. It's just, you know, a lot of disinformation, a lot of misinformation that some people would put out, you know, maliciously, and then other people just kind of take that as fact, you know. And it's been especially true with like anti-porn rhetoric and things like that.
I think that for me, and I'm sure some people who've been following discussions on my social media have noticed that I have decided to really come out swinging against the kind of purity culture discourse that we've seen emerge around, you know, the only legitimate form of queer media is so-called wholesome media. And what they mean by wholesome media is media that doesn't focus on sex. Or that if sex is going to be depicted in a show, it needs to be done in a really, really prescribed way that is tied to certain notions that are somewhat regressive, I think. So what kind of is concerning to me right now is how boys love has been implicated in this kind of purity culture discourse, and that it is emerging as a, like the backlash that we're seeing against BL from people who are trying to push this idea of, you know, the only legitimate media is wholesome queer media that doesn't have icky sex and blah, 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 is that they mobilize a very xenophobic discourse against boys' love. So in order, like that not only are they saying boys' love is problematic, but they position it as backward and dangerous because of its emergence from, for instance, Japan, which is quote unquote an empire of child porn.
It's weird, it's exotified.
Sexy. Yeah. And that's a really dangerous and disingenuous route to take. Because if feminist praxis is about listening to others and learning from them, particularly marginalized others, then to have a North American-centered Anglophone space dismiss the voices and experiences of fans, whether they be women or queer men or trans or what have you, across East and Southeast Asia, well, that's like extraordinarily problematic. And I you know, and I say this as a white gay male living in Australia, like I most appreciate boys love and the research that I've done on it because it has shaken my expectations and the centrality of my knowledge, right? So that what I have found most productive from a feminist and queer perspective is that engaging with the voices and the experiences of people across East and Southeast Asia has led me to question what I have always considered to be common sense. But what concerns me about the purity culture discourse and recent Anglophone discussions of BL as Asian media is that it's doing the opposite. It's trying to recenter the authority of the West and you know, educate these poor misguided girls in Japan who are doing such problematic stuff, because we, the Westerners, particularly white Westerners, we know better. And that's not the case. I mean, you just need to look at what's happening in the United States to see that particular nation state doesn't have a leg to stand on when it comes to discussing queer rights at all. And
So I guess that's a good way to step. I'm sorry. It's a good way to continue, at least perhaps wrap up, because we know we are encountering this. And if we want to at least, not, I wouldn't say combat, it's really hard to do that in many ways. Us scholars are doing it by writing more, by making our works more visible, etc. But I think for readers, when they do encounter these kinds of arguments, how best can they deepen their understanding of BL? How will they, and I think I speak for Catholic schoolgirls like myself, who, you know, to a certain extent have encountered some kind of purity politics in their consumption of anything that was sexual, anything that was queer, you know, how can they at least confront the shame that usually comes from these discussions and, you know, feel empowered by their consumption?
Really, the answer, Christine, is to say 10 Hail Marys. I'll defer this to Sam, because Sam, I think that when it comes, what I've really appreciated about your scholarship and your social media activism, if you don't mind me claiming it as activism, has been that you have been advocating for a particular way of engaging with discourse, which is designed to kind of structurally but also very reflexively determine whether or not something is a good faith or a bad faith argument. Because, like, my response is just read different opinions and be open to it. But Sam, I think you've kind of concretized that a little bit more.
Yes.
So I might leave it the final words to you.
Well, I'll definitely say thank you, because I really appreciate that. But yeah, I know you mentioned read, but honestly, I think that's one of the core things, is just sharing resources with people, largely too, because since I started putting my database together, trying to find as many, you know, articles as I could relating to all these topics on sexuality, sexual expression, BL, feminism, queer texts, all these things combined. I've been contacted by numerous people over the past couple of years who have thanked me, and they said, you know, I changed my opinion, you know what, you know, I gave this a chance, and I really appreciate that, you know, or the way I would talk to some people, without getting too hostile at first, they were like, thanks for giving me a chance, you know, and looking into this stuff. And it's like, obviously, you know, not everybody's going to respond that way. There's plenty of people who, you know, might dismiss it or react hot in a hostile way. But, you know, some of these people genuinely want to do the right thing, and so they just listen to the people who are the loudest or have the loudest argument. But when they, you know, presented with new information, they do change their opinion, they do change their mind. And overall, I'm optimistic, just, you know, in the sense of, like, if enough people keep bringing attention to this, because I know already since I started my archive, like, a couple years ago, like, anytime there's a post about with BL misinformation, I see people's, many of them who follow me will pop up and be like, actually, did you know this? I recommend this article here, you know? And like, it, or they'll share my resources, and it makes me really happy, because that's kind of what I put it together for. So, like, people would just have that resource and be able to quickly rectify misinformation or get people to think about a different perspective, you know, based on some of the quotes that are on the website or whatever from actual Japanese writers and scholars or queer activists. And so I know a lot of people say that express some hopelessness or pessimism about it, but I'm overall hopeful since the changes I've seen in the past few years, since I started this around, like, really, I started doing this around fall 2019. Yeah.
I think on that note, and I guess to a certain extent, and this is a queer feminist scholar putting it, the reparative actions that we can do in terms of BL, wherein we can, mm-hmm. you know, have a deeper understanding through, you know, really having a more intersectional understanding of the genre, of the community, and the texts, right? And mm-hmm. and in the process empower a lot of its consumers, you know, for whatever gender that they wish to identify, you know, as a consumer, as a creator of BL works, you know. And I guess
a lot of people would also just express, you know, internalized shame or things like that. But just by having these resources, they realize, oh, I'm normal.
There's nothing wrong with me.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Yeah. And I think it's one way to combat the shame that a lot of these patriarchal structures, these purity politics, these puritanical discourses are trying to push onto many of these consumers of BL. And the truth is, as long as conservatism and these louder figures are there, they will be there. But I think at least having these tools will inform and empower quite a lot of women and men and other consumers of BL, right? Mm-hmm. And on that note, I guess I'd like to thank Samantha and Thomas for being with us and this early morning on my end. The sun is finally up on my side of the world. But I want to thank you for this discussion, and I want to thank you for giving your time and expertise on this matter. And I definitely, if you want to continue to learn from Sam and from Tom, I'll be posting their Twitter. I'll be posting Sam's wonderful database on my blog, which I don't know if people still read, but I hope that if I post it on Twitter, you will at least have access to it, and it will fight all of the Google algorithms and emerge if you try to look for this kind of discussion. But yeah, again, thank you, Tom and Sam, for your time. And on that note, thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Thank you. Thank you.